Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Epidemic is not a word to be thrown around lightly, but there may be no more appropriate word to describe the rise in ADHD in America. 11% of U.S. children between the ages of 4 and 17 had been diagnosed with the condition by 2011, and 6% of all children were being medicated to control ADHD symptoms. But while drugs can make a difference, my guest believes they are too often prescribed to children whose impulsivity, disorganization, and lack of focus might stem from stress or trauma rather than brain disorders. Marilyn Wedge is a family therapist with a PhD in social psychology and author of A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. Marilyn, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write about the startling increase in ADHD diagnoses since the late 80s when you began your career as a child therapist. What accounts for that?
Well, first of all, I think the DSM-3 revised edition, which came out in 1987, introduced the diagnosis of ADHD. And then there has been a lot of marketing of the medication cure, so-called, for kids who are inattentive or who like to squirm in the classroom. So I think those two things, the DSM-3R, the revised edition, the DSM-4, and then the DSM-5, they've extended the age at which a child may be diagnosed. In the DSM-3, it was age 6, and now it is age 4. So all of those things combined with very high-level marketing by the pharmaceutical companies for medication cures have led to our children being diagnosed and medicated in these vast numbers.
What has to be ruled out before an ADHD diagnosis is confirmed?
Well, ruled out that there are other causes for the difficult behavior. So let's say if a child has an organic brain disease, there are true brain diseases that cause hyperactivity, encephalitis, meningitis, brain tumor, epilepsy, head injury. So those are a different category. Those are organic disorders. Anxiety disorders are often confused and difficult to rule out because anxiety in a child looks very much like hyperactivity, squirminess, fidgetiness, inability to pay attention. So those kinds of things need to be ruled out.
What is the difference between the inattentive and hyperactive impulsive forms of ADHD? Because they can have separate sets of symptoms, right?
Sure, exactly. You can have inattentive form. And mostly girls are diagnosed with this form. It's that they don't pay close attention to the teacher, or they lose their pencils, or forget to bring in their homework. So it's not a motor activity kind of thing. It's just forgetfulness, not listening carefully to the teacher's instructions, being dreamy in class. The hyperactive form is more kids who are on the go. It's mostly boys who get squirmy and fidgety in class if they have to sit in class for 6 or 8 hours with very little recess, little physical education. So it's kind of kids who are on the go, who fidget with their pencils, who like to move around and don't always want to wait their turn.
So you and I can probably think back to our days in elementary school and think of a few kids who fit this description who did not receive such a diagnosis. How did we handle, before the DSM began to codify ADHD in these ways, how did we handle kids who were inattentive or who were fidgety or had trouble focusing?
That's a really good question, Chris. I think about that a lot. Usually, if I think back to when I was in elementary school in the 50s and 60s, there was always one kid in the class, usually a boy, And he was sent out to the corridor to wait 15 minutes in the corridor. And it was not only that boy. I mean, some of the rest of us were sent out to the corridor. And it was a very shameful experience. I remember once I was talking too much with my neighbor and I had to wait in the corridor. It was kind of a shaming experience. But, you know, I didn't do it again. So I think there was more discipline in the school level by sending a child to the corridor, sending a child to the principal's office. It seemed to be handled by the teacher. The classrooms, I think, weren't as crowded as they are today.
How do diagnosis rates in the United States for ADHD compare with those of other industrialized Western countries?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and that's really how I got started with this book. When I was seeing more and more children coming into my office diagnosed with ADHD and some of them already taking psychiatric medications, I began to wonder what was going on in other countries. Were they seeing the same thing? Were children around the world having an epidemic? So the first research I came upon was research about France and French children. And this was a fascinating story because when the DSM-3 arrived in France in 1980, the French child psychiatrists they thought this was absurd. They just weren't going to use it. So they wrote in 1981 their own manual of child mental disorders. And so their rate of diagnosis and of medication is much lower. It's less than 1%. The reason being that they see the child in the context of their world, in the context of their family, of their school, of their friends. And the therapist or the psychiatrist would spend 8 sessions carefully talking with the child and the child's family, trying to see what kind of situation might be stressful to the child. This is opposed to the United States, where a child can receive a diagnosis in 15 minutes and a prescription for a powerful psychiatric drug. So the diagnostic process is very different, and that accounts for fewer diagnoses. In a country like Finland, the rate of diagnosis and medication is 0.01%, 1/100th of a percent. Because there, this inattentiveness and hyperactivity is seen as a challenge for educators. So an education team at the school will intervene with the child and make sure that child has the help that he needs. It may be psychological counseling, maybe family counseling, maybe special classroom groups, small groups. So it's just not seen as a medical disorder as much in other countries.
Has the nature of what we expect from kids in schools changed?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, it's almost unbelievable. In my practice, I see that kindergartners are coming home with homework. And by third or fourth grade, these children have more homework than I had in high school. So, yeah, there is this emphasis on more homework, more productivity. And this, again, contrasts with other countries. In Finland, children don't get homework in elementary school. And the class day is only 4 hours instead of 6 or 8 hours, as it is in this country. And for every 45 minutes of classroom instruction in Finland, children get to run around and play. So here, we have less and less recess and physical education and more emphasis on academic performance at all costs.
How does the, access to exercise affect, how things go in the day for a child who's been diagnosed with ADHD?
Huge. I mean, this is just a huge topic. A child who's been diagnosed with ADHD can, if they get enough exercise, if they even walk to school for 20 minutes with their parents walking with them, they do better in school. Some kids need to squirm to learn. They need to walk around the classroom or have more breaks or get more physical exercise. And I think this is one of the other reasons that children are diagnosed so much, because kids these days are sitting in the classroom, they come home, they're glued to the video game screen, and they're not running and playing and riding their bikes and some of them play sports, which is a very good alternative to medication. But I do think there needs to be more emphasis on physical education and physical activity as an aid to learning.
You talk about stresses and traumas that can trigger the kinds of symptoms that we associate with ADHD, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But could, like, lack of exercise actually be one of those triggers that causes children to act up?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. It definitely can be, yeah.
So what kinds of other stresses in life can cause kids, maybe temporarily, maybe for a period of years, to behave in ways that we today would diagnose as ADHD?
Well, this is a big subject. Childhood adverse experiences, like such as trauma, and trauma has a wide spectrum. So on the very far end of trauma is severe trauma, such as being raised in poverty or abuse or neglect or molestation. That's severe trauma. But there are lesser traumas. Even hearing parents argue on a regular basis is traumatic to a child and can cause them to act out and be squirmy and inattentive. Or having a parent lose a job can be traumatic to the child if they hear the parents fighting or realize that the family is in need of financial resources. But then there's also very mild trauma, such as even a movie like Bambi. When if a young child watches it, they can have bad dreams and nightmares because it's scary. So there's a whole range of traumatic experiences. And I think it really boils down to the family and how much the family protects the child from influences that could distress him. So just even one example, if a mother has an illness, a severe illness, the child needs to be protected as much as possible because having a parent be ill distresses a child. It can make them inattentive. It can be mistaken for ADHD. I remember one little boy who came in, a 5-year-old boy, who had been acting out in class after being a perfect child. And as I talked with the family, what emerged was that this boy was really worried about his father, who had a big cast on his arm and couldn't go to work because he had broken his arm and was home on disability. And the boy was just desperately worried about his father. Were things going to be normal again? So that kind of thing, children don't always explain why they're troubled. They tend to act on their feelings rather than explain. So it takes some work to figure out what was traumatizing this child, what was the child worried about, what was making him anxious, and it turned out to be his parents, his father's arm. So the cure in this case was not medication, but was having the parents reassure the boy that daddy would get well soon, and daddy even took him to his workplace and showed him around and said, here's where I work, here are my friends, and I'll be going back to work very soon. And the boy's behavior changed overnight.
I don't know if that child had siblings, but what accounts for the fact that in some families where children have pretty similar experiences at home, one child seems susceptible to if it's acting out in these ways that look like ADHD, while another one doesn't?
That's a really interesting point. And parents ask me that all the time. Our children were in the same environment, so how can it be the environment? You know, I don't know the real answer to that question, but some kids are just more sensitive, more tuned in to the parents than others. I think it's just a question of temperament, sensitivity, a closeness to one or the other parent that makes one child worry more. You know, it's kind of the child is taking the bullet, really, for the rest of the family. He's, you know, becoming symptomatic.
Marilyn Wedge is my guest. She's a family therapist with a PhD in social psychology and author of the new book, A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with family therapist Marilyn Wedge, author of a new book called A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Marilyn, when a child comes to you with the symptoms that other doctors might associate with ADHD, what do you call those symptoms if you don't necessarily think ADHD is a biochemical condition?
Well, I look for the environmental stressors that are triggering these behaviors. So, you know, I rarely see the child at all in therapy. I prefer to work really with the parents. And I look at what in the parent nurturing environment may be stressing the child. So if the parents are arguing, that's a huge trigger for kids to act as though they have ADHD. Are they having problems with a grandparent? Is a grandparent taking too much time in the marriage? Is the grandparent interfering in their marriage? That too can, you know, I had one little girl and she sat, I saw her for one session, and she sat down in my chair, and she said, I'm afraid my parents are going to get a divorce because my daddy hates my grandmother. And, of course, it wasn't true. That was an extreme exaggeration. But when I talked to the parents, the father did admit that he had problems with his wife's mother dropping over or spending so much time at their house, and he felt like it was taking away from his time with his wife and children. So I look for the family situation. I always ask about the grandparents, the parents' siblings. Sometimes if a parent's sibling is not doing well or has some kind of crisis, the child can be affected if they're close to that relative. So it's kind of not obvious, but it takes some interviewing of the parents to find out. And of course, I have to rule out if that child is suffering neglect or abuse, maybe by the parents, maybe by a non-family member. That happens too. So there are all kinds of things I look for, not as symptoms within the child, but as dysfunction within the environment that the child may be reacting to. I mean, sometimes a teacher, there's a conflict. Another very common thing is that the child is among the youngest in the classroom. If a child is in the youngest in the classroom, he has a 49% chance, higher chance of being diagnosed with ADHD than children who are older in the classroom. So what it is not a brain disease. It's immaturity. That child has not is perhaps not able to keep up with his older peers, because at age 5 or 6, half a year makes a lot of difference. So I really think that we've forgotten in our emphasis on biology and biological causes and brain disorders and brain chemicals, we've forgotten the environment and how the environment and who we are with affects our mental health.
Help me understand this. I'm not a mental health expert, but I haven't met a lot of parents who appear to have made the decision to try medication on a lark. You know, people typically give this a lot of thought.
Sure.
And they take a lot of factors into account, and they really are, in most cases, as far as I can see, trying to do the best they can for their children. Are parents getting pushed into this somehow?
Well, I agree with you. Parents are in general trying to do the best for their children. And yes, they are being pushed into it because doctors don't have the time to sit and do an extensive evaluation, an 8-hour evaluation of a child and the family to look at the family causes. I mean, I just have to tell you that I know when a child comes in, there is something in the child's environment that is bothering them. There is no evidence that this is a chemical disorder in the brain or a brain disorder. There is something bothering that child that the child cannot say. And I think parents, it's very painful and difficult to look at their marriage, at their boss. Maybe they're having problems with their boss and they feel trapped and there's nowhere to go. I think it's really difficult for parents to look at this for two reasons. First, it's very painful. And secondly, what does this have to do with my child? What does my arguing with my husband have to do with my child's medical disorder? And so it's very hard to think outside the box, outside the medical disorder box. And then the pediatricians and the child psychiatrists have learned in medical school that the best solution for these behaviors is medication. They haven't learned family therapy. They used to, but they haven't in the last 3 decades. And so they they too have the best interests of the child at heart. They guide them in the best way they know. So, yeah, there's this cultural tendency to push toward medication.
There are some people who say, well, if the medication works, then that's evidence that clearly this is something that needed medication. Does that make sense to you? And how do you respond to that?
Not at all. That's just not true at all. This medication, amphetamines, which Adderall is an amphetamine, let's just take that one drug, they were invented in the 1930s in a drug called Benzedrine, which is very similar in chemical molecular structure to Adderall. It was used by the German Air Force to conduct the Blitzkrieg. They took these Benzedrine pills to help the pilots stay calm and focused during their air raids. Well, when the American military found out about this, they put Bennies in the kit of every American pilot. So amphetamines have been known to help anyone focus, stay calm, and concentrate for short periods of time. And so in the 1930s, a pediatrician named Charles Bradley, a very devoted pediatrician, did some experiments with Benzedrine on two sets of children, children with documented brain disorders and children with behavioral problems, which he believed stemmed from trauma at home. And he found that on the day they took the Bennies, the children became more attentive. And on the day he stopped giving them the Benzedrine, the children went back to their previous behavior. And the children noticed that these pills helped them at school. They called them arithmetic pills. So, yes, the drugs do help, but they help in the sense of being a performance enhancer, not a medicine. Benzedrine helps anybody focus. Amphetamines are now being used by 30 to 60% of college students as performance enhancers. And these students don't have ADHD, by and large. They buy the prescriptions or are given the prescriptions by their friends who do have a medical diagnosis, or they go to a psychiatrist's office and they know what to say to get the diagnosis and get the pills. So it's a performance enhancer for these college students. And now even in the workplace, we've been learning that amphetamines are very common. They hype productivity. But that's what we're doing to our children. We're giving them a mental steroid, a performance enhancer that hypes productivity in just about anyone. It is in no sense a medicine.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Ricky in Fort Worth. Hi, Ricky.
Hi there. This is a little bit off of what you were just off the subject of what you were just talking about, but I went to school, I went to college, and I got a film degree, and my primary focus in that was editing. And what I noticed as I was learning to edit as a student is that editing nowadays is much, much faster paced, and it's my pet theory that a lot of the ADD and ADHD diagnoses are a result of kids watching not only too much television, but even the television that they do watch, it's nonstop eye candy. It's nonstop movement all the time, and it's no wonder that they can't sit still in a classroom all day. What do you think about that?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you for that call. Yeah, there is research saying precisely what you just said, and I really thank you for bringing it up. All of this overstimulating eye candy does affect a child's brain. There was a research study done couple of decades ago showing that a fast-paced television show as compared to no television show or a PBS show affected a child's ability to take a test. The children who watched the fast-paced TV show did less well on the test than the controlled group of children who had no television and also the group who watched a PBS show, which was more naturally paced. So, yeah, you're right. The fast pace of the TV screens and the video game screens, it scrambles the brain. And so I always recommend that a child have only 1 hour a day of video game time. And parents look at me and they can't even believe it that I would, you know, it seems very extreme, but it's not. And this is definitely, you've actually pinpointed it, that this fast-paced screens are part of what's leading to this mass diagnosis of ADHD.
The study that you described makes sense, that after children have watched a program that is really fast-paced, they don't concentrate as well. Has there also been demonstrated a cumulative effect over time that sort of persists beyond, you know, the hour after they've watched that, you know, quickly edited piece of content?
I don't know of research on that, Chris. I honestly don't know. It may exist or may not. But it's just my clinical experience that kids who spend a lot of time day after day on screens start to do poorly in school.
What do we know, Marilyn, about the effect of diet on the way that kids behave?
Well, this is very controversial. But, you know, just last week, Kraft Foods made a momentous decision, and they decided to change the way they colored their famous macaroni and cheese products, which kids love. Instead of using artificial food colorings, Kraft has said they will use natural food colorings from natural sources like carrots and saffron. So this is the best testament that I can find to show that there is an influence of diet on children's hyperactive behavior. The main research was done in the 70s by American pediatrician Benjamin Feingold, and he found that if you give some children are sensitive in the sense of an allergy. Some kids are allergic to artificial food colorings and preservatives in foods. And he did more anecdotal case studies, but his research was followed up and replicated by a famous study in England called the Southampton Study. It was a placebo-controlled crossover study of three food dyes and preservatives, artificial food dyes and preservatives. As a result of this study, the European counterpart of the FDA, the British Food Standards Agency, told food companies that they would have to label products with these food dyes as possibly causing hyperactivity in some children. The food companies said, we're not going to label, we're going to change our ways. They started using only natural food colorings from beets, saffron, carrots, and those kinds of foods. But they did not change the way they sold products in the United States. The products for children in the United States continue to have artificial food colorings. And the FDA said because it was a group of food dyes, three food dyes, that the research was not conclusive and they were not going to ask food companies to label their products. However, the consumer voice is being heard, and recently Nestle voluntarily announced that they would be using only natural food colorings in the United States. And as I said, Kraft lately decided that they would only use natural food colorings. So, you know, there is research, and it has been ignored by and large in the United States because of the FDA stance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Kevin in San Antonio. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to give your guest, I don't even know her name, this is the first time I kind of listened to the program.
It's Dr. Marilyn Wedge.
Because she's speaking so much truth. As a background in elementary school teaching that I have, I see a lot of these drugs being given to the children with a very, very quick diagnosis with teachers that aren't, they're chiming in and giving them recommendations to some of the parents, saying, yeah, I think your child may need, you know, some enhancers to stay a little bit focused. They don't actually speak those exact words, but they kind of push them towards that. I've seen it a lot in elementary school, you know, 5 and 6 year old. And it just takes a little bit of knowledge and research about child development to understand that at that age in 5 and 6, those children may be just a little bit immature.
What do you think about that, Marilyn?
I totally agree. Thank you so much for your call. Because I totally agree. Kids who are 5 and 6, in European countries, they don't even start school until 7. You know, these kids need to run and play. They're not emotionally equipped to sit still in a classroom or even sit in circle time for half an hour. So I really think you're spot on in your observations of these young children.
Of course, teachers who have, you know, year after year, they've got 25 kids in the classroom, it would seem evident to them when some kids are struggling more than others. Your point is not that these children don't need some extra help, it's that they may not need medication. Am I correct about that?
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. They certainly could use extra help. And some schools here that I know of have small classrooms that they meet, you know, kids who need extra help. They meet in a small group, say 3 or 4 children, and they get individual attention from a learning specialist until they get up to speed. Other children, you can make adjustments in the home, like not having the television set on when they come home and do their homework, or having a parent sit with them at the kitchen table while they do their homework, and the parent can help them as needed. So with extra support, some parents have tutors, they have high school students to help tutor if they can't be home, if they have to be at work. So there's all kinds of support that these kids can be getting. But it takes more work and it takes more research, and it's not as easy as giving the kid a pill.
Marilyn Wedge is my guest. She's a family therapist with a PhD in social psychology and author of the new book, A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with family therapist and author Marilyn Wedge. Her new book is called A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Marilyn, if the drugs can work for some children who have these symptoms and, you know, help them do better in school and help their behavior, why are they not a good thing? Why are they not a reasonable option?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that it provides the child with a crutch to lean on. And so the child grows thinking that they are dependent on a pill to help them learn. Michael Phelps, for example, was diagnosed with ADHD when he was around 10 and given medication. And he became embarrassed taking this at school. The school nurse would come and find him and give him his pill. And he decided that it was a crutch and that he wanted to control his behavior by himself. And so he took up swimming. And that was a wonderful outlet for his extra energy and fidgetiness. So that's one reason, that it becomes a crutch and the child feels he needs that drug. The second and perhaps more serious reason is that it can become an addiction later in life. If a child, there's studies coming out now about this, if a child learns in elementary school that this is a good way to do well in school, then he continues to use the drug in high school. And then in college, when he's faced with a challenging class, his first impulse is to get a pill, to use a pill. And so we're seeing an epidemic of college students, and I think I mentioned this earlier, college students are using these stimulants to enhance their productivity, to go without sleep, and it's not healthy. It really it's a performance enhancer, and why would we object to steroids in sports, to athletes using steroids, and not object to children and adolescents and young adults using mental steroids? So I think the most serious thing is the question of addiction, and there is research showing that it can become addictive if the child continues to use it over a long period of time.
Have you seen patients or families of patients who feel like they've tried everything else and the only thing they haven't done is medication? Does it always work, for example, to do talk therapy and to sort of examine the home environment? Can you always find a solution that way?
Well, I think I can always, but there are parents who are not willing to do it, or there it's just too painful that the problems have become entrenched. And when I try to work with them, I'm thinking of one couple with a daughter who's, I think, about 11, and she wasn't doing well. And they just were not willing to deal with the marriage problems, and they were pressured by the whole performance mentality, the schools. You know, my kid has to learn, and anything to help them learn. They didn't want to take the time to go into the marriage problems and to do family therapy. So I think it does always work, unless there's an organic cause. Recently, I met a mother whose daughter had a brain injury from a basketball, and it was found that when she took stimulants, it helped her at school. If there's a real organic problem, like a brain injury, a brain tumor, or a disease, then I think it's acceptable because there's no other way to address the problem. But I have always found a family or environmental solution. Maybe it's a boyfriend breakup. Maybe it's friends who are turning on a girl. If we sort those problems out, I've always been able to get a child off medication.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Aetna in Dallas. Hi, Aetna.
Hi. With all due respect, your guest is so full of crap. My son, at 3 years old, people knew. You know, he stood out even with energy. He would run around the other three-year-olds. My daughter was on the rotation diet, so we didn't have any of those foods in that, you know, in our house. And my daughter makes fun of us because we didn't know. She said we didn't know what McDonald's was until she was seven. And my son would come home and he would self-medicate himself in a way because he loved what he called the Fish Channel, which was the Dallas Aquarium. It was on TV. They showed the fish tanks with classical music behind it. Mm. So he wasn't watching video games. And, you know, what she's neglected to mention is a huge part of ADHD is the H, which is hyperactivity. His impulse control got scary, or lack of it, got scary.
Thank you so much for that call, Aetna. I appreciate it. What about kids, Marilyn, who would appear to be a danger to themselves because of impulsivity?
Well, there are kids who, by temperament, are very energetic and move around. And it's interesting what she said about self-medicating, finding that channel. I had a boy, and I talk about him in the book, named Ricky, and he knew he had a hard time calming down. And I once asked him, are you always in motion? He said, no, not when I'm sleeping. And also I found this YouTube video, which was a meditation video with the sound of waves. And when I listen to that, I'm calm. And so he showed me where the YouTube video was, and we put it on my computer, and we listened to it, and Ricky became calm and sat in one place. And so his parents refused to medicate because they really felt that it was his temperament and that there were other ways to deal with it. And so, but here again is a child who found a way to self-medicate, listening to the sound of waves. And it really helped him. We did get some accommodations at the school for him. he was allowed to get up and stretch. He was allowed to leave his seat. He was the blackboard monitor, so he could get up and erase the blackboard. He was the monitor of the plants. He got up and watered the plants during the day. So there are accommodations that can be made at the school and at home for these very active and sometimes very brilliant children.
Some schools are great about making those accommodations. Some parents will tell you that they've tried to get these and really come up against a brick wall. What do you do in situations where either the school doesn't want to make accommodations or one finds that a child who has these behaviors is starting to be labeled as like the bad kid in school, and that begins to affect the way they think of themselves?
Sure. And that's a serious situation. Well, I'm not advocating this for everyone, but some parents told me that when their kid can't do well at school and the school has more or less said either you medicate your child or take him out of the school, they found that homeschooling helped the child so much that they didn't have any more symptoms of ADHD. So I'm not saying every parent can homeschool, but if you change the environment to some extent, perhaps a different school, perhaps a different teacher, just keep advocating for your child until you find a situation where you can have accommodations made.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sharmina in Plano. Hi, Sharmina.
Hi, Jess. Just a wonderful show, especially because I've been studying a lot about this these days at UTD. But I wanted to just get a suggestion. I have four kids, and when we got married, we decided we weren't going to have a television in the house. So we don't have a TV, but we do let them watch, they have time limits on the computer. They're aged between 6 and 13, so they get an hour max during the day on the computer. But I feel like, what's happened sometimes is they sit together and they overlap, they get more than the hour, or like one of your other callers mentioned, what they're watching is just, the scenes are changing every 2 seconds and there's so much going on. How do you limit the timing without getting backlash from your kids? Because what my kids will say to me then is, you only let us have an hour, and so-and-so has a Nintendo game, has this, has that, has an iPod, and they get to watch whatever they want to watch. And, how do you work with your kids without being the bad guy? I don't know.
I totally empathize with the caller because I had the same situation at home. We didn't have a television. So I always got, so-and-so watches this and that. All I can say is give your kids the opportunity to have fun outdoor adventures or sports. Enroll them in sports. You can always find alternatives to screens, whether indoor sports or outdoor sports or bicycle riding or hiking in the woods with the parents or swimming. There's always some physical activity that can be enjoyable for children that is a better alternative for their health than screens.
Do you have suggestions, Marilyn, for people who would like to be able to provide their children who have these symptoms with, say, regular therapy, or they would like to meet with a counselor and figure out parenting, but frankly can't afford it?
Well, that's a big problem with our society. What comes to mind is that Medicaid, children on Medicaid who have that as their health insurance, Medicaid only pays for psychiatry and medication. It does not pay for family therapy or individual therapy. And therefore, you get this high percentage of children that are disadvantaged on medication, which is tragic. I really think that our country could use some reform, such as Finland instituted in the 1970s, of trying to do early intervention at the school, seeing what children could use extra help and support, and not seeing it as a medical issue but as an educational challenge, and giving them the support they need. And, of course, that would take funding, either private or federal. But I think it's so important to combat this epidemic, to put some attention and some resources on it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Elena in Fort Worth. Hi, Elena.
Hi. I was just wanted to add, I've been in education as a preschool teacher for 18 years. Some of those years I even worked for the state as a intervention specialist. And I have...
Are you with us, Elena?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I have never seen a kid that I could say would actually have ADHD in 18 years. If you find something that they're inclined to, that they have an ability that they like, they can sit there and perform the skill for 30 or more minutes.
What do you think about that, Marilyn?
Oh, Elena, thank you so much for that. Your 18 years of experience is very precious for children. It's true. I mean, some kids are not academically inclined. They may be good at singing or dancing or gymnastics. And so in the classroom, they don't seem to be doing well, but they have different skills. As Elena said, they have different abilities that that they can do very well and they can focus on for longer periods of time. So thank you so much for saying you've never seen a child with ADHD in 18 years, because that's my experience. There's always a way to help a child, unless they have an organic brain problem.
What's the balance between holding children accountable for their behavior and holding the adults in their lives accountable for their behavior?
Well, the problem with medication, you know, and diagnosis is that a child can say, well, I can't behave because I have ADHD. So I can do what I want and it's not my fault. So I think medication and diagnosis does take away accountability from children and as well as parents. Parents feel that if their child has a disease, an illness like diabetes or bronchitis, they have nothing to do with it. It's not their fault. So they give them medication and they don't feel accountable. And so discipline goes by the wayside. I think a lot of parents are just too tired and stressed by their lives to put in place calm, consistent discipline for their child, and having a calm, consistent structure at home, a family dinner hour that is not interrupted by television or texting their friends. So I think parents need to take more accountability for this, frankly.
If you had to name two or three elements of structure that kids really need, what would you suggest that parents focus on?
I would suggest that they focus on a family dinner time with healthy, nutritious foods, a bedtime that is agreed on by both parents, and a kind of structure in the afternoon so that kids know what to expect, what time they're going to do their homework. There are a lot of fights and power struggles about whether the kids should play video games or start their homework. So there should be a time, 5 o'clock, 5:30, whatever works for the family, that the child knows that this is the time they're going to begin their homework. And their parent is going to sit down with them at the table. And if they need help, they get help with their homework.
Marilyn Wedge is a family therapist with a PhD in social psychology, and she's author of the new book, A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. Marilyn, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, Chris, it's been a great pleasure being here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.